So, welcome everybody. This is the sixth lecture in my course on Tranquility and Insight. It has again been a very lively discussion on the forum, which I really appreciate. So, first of all, thanks to all of you who have made a contribution to that. There's something in general that I would like to say before I go into some of the individual points. There's a passage from Bhikkhu Bodhi I would like to read. This is in a book called Approaching the Dhamma. And he has written a paper on this called Musila and Narada Revisited. This is about discourse that has led to a long-standing controversy among the significance of tranquility and insight in the early Buddhist scriptures. And I think his hermeneutical approach that he proposes here, I think is extremely meaningful. So what Bhikkhu Bodhi says is, although the Pali Suttas are noted for the exceptional clarity and simplicity of their teachings, to the thoughtful interpreter, they can sometimes be as opaque and mystifying as a cryptogram. Not only are the texts themselves composed in a clipped, laconic style that mocks our thirst for conceptual completeness, but their meaning often seems to rest upon a deep underlying groundwork of interconnected ideas that is nowhere stated boldly in a way that might guide interpretation. Instead of resorting to direct expression, the Nikayas embed the basic principles of doctrine in a multitude of short, often elusive discourses that draw upon and allude to the underlying system without explicitly spelling it out. To determine the principles, one has to extract them piecemeal by considering in juxtaposition a wide assortment of texts. Yet this method, if applied without due caution, can easily drag the unwary interpreter into the notorious hermeneutic circle to gain access to the exegetical system underlying the suttas. One must understand them. To understand the suttas, one needs access to the underlying exegetical system. Given this quandary, it is hardly a cause for wonder that present-day scholars of early Buddhism arrive at such strikingly different interpretations of the Nikayas. But the hermeneutic circle need not be a vicious trap. By proceeding heedfully, with the combined aid of intuition and reflection, we can often discover enough of the exegetical framework to help us decipher the texts in accordance with their implicit intention. Yeah, I find this extremely useful, and this is the approach that I adopt myself. And Korean scholar Jungnok Park calls that a systematic approach. And this is really what I think is required if our wish is not, let me exaggerate a little bit, if we don't have just a preconceived opinion of how things should be, and we are simply looking for evidence to prove that, but much rather if our attempt is a sincere and honest wish to understand. To understand the entirety of the system of early Buddhist thought based on this piecemeal information found here and there, then such a systematic approach is required. And in such a systematic approach, we don't take a single passage out of context, and because this particular one passage fits our own ideas, but try to see it always within context. Yeah, I think this is a very important approach, and this is an approach that has not been observed by Buddhist schools throughout history. This is where we get a lot of discussions and degree of disagreement between them throughout history. And the same problem is also with some of my academic colleagues, I think. So, there's a lot of discussion on the jhanas. My hermeneutical comment was meant very much in general. It's not in particular to those I'm now quoting. It was just, I thought, in general, it would be good to clarify the approach that I think is the most useful one if we want to understand. This is from Venerable Xinchen. So she quotes a passage from Bhikkhu Bodhi to the effect that the four immaterial attainments have the same jhana factors as the fourth jhana, or in the Abhidharma system of reckoning, that would be the fifth jhana. And then she says, if arupa jhanas can be included in the fifth form jhana, does this mean that there is no difference between them in the development of tranquility and insight? And then she continues, she refers to Majjhima Nikaya 64. This discourse shows that the arupa jhanas and the rupa jhanas have different function in the development of insight. And aren't the arupa jhanas the deeper meditative attainments than the fifth form jhana? So I personally prefer to speak of the immaterial spheres not as jhanas, because that is not the terminology used in the early discourses, as immaterial attainments. And I prefer to also speak of the fifth Abhidharma style as the fourth, because it's the fourth in the sutta, so that there's no confusion. But the question is, one question is, does the, what I was trying to say, and I'm coming back to that topic right away with the next contribution, is that as far as we are able to tell, the basic mindset of the experience of the immaterial spheres is the same as that of the fourth jhana. They are the same mental factors. But this, of course, does not mean that the subjective experience of these attainments is not considerably more profound and deeper. It definitely is, but the progressive deepening of concentration that takes place is based on a refinement of the object. Yeah, we have two determining influences on the depth of the subjective experience, and one of these is the condition of the mind, the mental factors that are there. And this, in the fourth jhana, is the same set, as far as we are able to tell, than in the immaterial spheres. The other aspect is the object. So the more I refine the object by letting all traces of materiality disappear, and I have just boundless space, and then from boundless space I turn to that which experience space, boundless consciousness. And then I even let go of that. There's a progressive refinement, and there is no doubt that these are more profound and deeper experiences. And that therefore also the question of tranquility and insight in relation to these is different. Yeah, Venerable Xinchen also had a question about the Mahavibhasha. And I'm not really able, or not really wanting to go into that too much, because my attempt here is to try to stay with tranquility insight in the level of what we could call early Buddhist source material. And I'm not sure always if the commentaries, whether Theravada, Savasvara, whatever, accurately reflect that, or may not at sometimes have developed an understanding of their own, which has its value, no doubt. But at present, my concern is to stay with that one historical strata of the early discourse, and try to see if we can get some understanding of what's happening there. And then based on that understanding, I think, the next step would be for us to then look at later tradition. Now, there was Justin Williams. He's fired about 8 entries in the blog, in the forum, one after the other on this topic, so I have a lot of things to discuss with him. Really lovely, when I said, wow, he was really, really going for that. Beautiful. So all the things that are coming now from Justin Williams. First question, do you have any references from the early suttas for the immaterial attainments as being the fourth jhana? Oh yeah, I put in Kramer Eric van Horn also questioned that. He said, I would appreciate, excuse me, if you could elaborate on your statement that the arupas are deeper levels of the fourth jhana. Yeah, so this is one of these types of questions where we have to look at the overall system of presentation. Now we get analysis of mental states that progressively deepens from the ones from the first to the fourth jhana. Let's leave aside number five, Abhidhamma system. But we do not get anything that goes beyond. And this fourth jhana is described as aninja, as imperturbable. A level of mind that is described as imperturbable, I mean, you can't be more than imperturbable. And the thing is, the word imperturbable is explicitly used for the immaterial attainments. So there's a description of the profundity of the concentration that is shared between the fourth absorption and the immaterial attainments. This makes it, to my eye, very natural to conclude that they refer to the same degree of mental imperturbability, to the same level of concentrative strength of mind. The expression imperturbability is sometimes only used for some of the immaterial attainments, thus in the Sunakatta Sutta, it refers only to the lower two. And in the Panchatayya Sutta, the nothingness, the third is referred to as imperturbable, so we have some flexibility in the use of this word. This is aninja, and this is precisely the next discourse that we will be taking up after having gone through the interesting contributions on the forum. It's on imperturbability. And in the Aninja Sapaya Sutta, we will see different aspects of that. But it seems to me clear that once this term is used, that the explanation given more explicitly in later tradition that the fourth material jhana in terms of mental condition jhana factors corresponds to what is the state of mind that experiences the immaterial spheres is a meaningful explanation. We do have to be careful with the commentaries because they obviously speak from their viewpoint of their time. At the same time, however, I think it is also good for us to be aware of the fact that they were some 2,000 years or a little less, at least 1,500 years closer to early Buddhism than we are. Therefore, it is good to look at what they say and then look, does it match the evidence we have? And in this case, I take it that the evidence we have matches this aspect of the commentarial explanation. Then the next question by Justin. Could you provide references for non-Buddhists before, during the time of the Buddha practicing jhana? Yeah, a very strong evidence for this would be the Brahmajala Sutta. I'm again coming up here with Bhikkhu Bodhi. He has written this book on the Brahmajala Sutta with the translation of the commentary, the all-embracing net of views. And in his introduction, he points out that there is numbers of views, and these are all not right view in the Buddhist sense, but these are all misleading views, which are clearly based on meditative experience, and most of them on jhana experience. And we get it quite explicitly in, and I give you the reference if you wish to look it up. that is an exposition of what is called Ditta Dhamma Nibbanavada, views, proposals of Nirvana here and now. And these involve the description of jhana as we get it when we get instructions for Buddhist disciples. It's exactly the same description. So it is very clear that from the view of the reciters or the speaker of the Brahmajala Sutta, these jhanas were known and practiced by contemporary practitioners, and they led to wrong views. And this is very difficult to combine such a presentation with the idea that the Buddha would have discovered jhana as something of his own. We would get some more statements on this. There's one passage, and I just give you the two references, that is sometimes used to argue that the Buddha discovered jhana, it was unknown before him. That was by Michael Beisert. He pointed out that this passage is there, and there is an expression that's called jhanam abuddhi or abuddhi. The thing here is, again, if we adopt a systematic approach, this is a verse. And with verses, we have to be aware of the fact that due to metrical reasons, because this is poetry, they sometimes make a particular point in short. But we need to go beyond this one verse or stanza to see what is the actual context. And if we look at it within the context, we find in the second of these two references I gave, the Anguttara, Michael Beisert gave, I'm sorry, in the Anguttara passage, actually the first passage from the Samyutta is being quoted and is being given an explicit exegesis within the Sutta. And in that longer explanation, there is no reference whatsoever to the idea that the Buddha discovered jhana itself. But much rather, it's all on him discovering what within that experience needs to be let go of for further refinement. That is, first absorption, not Buddha discovered the first absorption, he discovered that within that experience, vitaka and vichara, however we like to translate it, need to be left behind to proceed to the second. And the second jhana piti, joy or rapture, however you would like to translate it, needs to be left behind to go to the third, etc. So it is, I think, indubitably clear that the expression abuddhi, abuddhi, awakened to jhana, does not mean awakened to the fact that there is jhana, but much rather awakened to how one proceeds to go higher and higher and higher in cultivation. The understanding of what are the factors that need to be left behind in order to proceed further, instead of just allowing the, let's just kind of keep on practicing, at some point going deeper without really understanding why. This kind of analytical approach makes it much easier to go deeper in concentration, and at the same time, because of this mental analysis that is brought in, it becomes easier to connect the whole to insight also. And then the suttas, again, if you adopt the systematic approach, the suttas are so strong on what the Buddha discovered. Like, he discovered the Four Noble Truths, he discovered the path to awakening. If the Buddha had discovered jhana, if jhana practice had been unknown before him, it would be mentioned somewhere, if you look at the teachings as a whole. So it seems to me, again, if we want to adopt an approach that tries to understand the complex system of early Buddhist teachings, and we do this systematic approach, then I think the idea that the Buddha discovered jhana, that jhana was unknown in contemporary ancient Indian circles, is not a very probable view. But of course, if you wish to hold that view, I mean, I thought before when I started this course, I thought, I'm going to get into a lot of controversy. I should be careful. it's not my point is not that I want to force down my view and kind of like, okay, you get straight from the horse's mouth and this is not the final point. I'm aware that people have different opinions, and basically I just present my humble understanding based on my studies, and you take it every way you like. But I just want to give you one example. This is from a, not from the form, this is from a friend of mine. It's a Dhammapada verse. Yeah, so this colleague and friend of mine has written a very nice thesis arguing that the Brahma Viharas, loving kindness or benevolence, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, were a path to awakening completely on their own, originally. And there was no need for insight whatsoever. And if you look through the book, a lot of interesting observation, but the main evidence we have is this one verse. Metta vihari yo bhikkhu pasanno buddhasasane adigacche parang santang sankharupa samang sukang. So the monk who dwells in metta and pasanno who has serene faith in the teaching of the Buddha will go to the place of peace or the path of peace, the appeasement of all conditioned formations, the happiness of the appeasement of all conditioned formations. So if we take this one verse completely out of context, then we can really argue, look, I mean, all what is mentioned here is practice of metta and having faith in the Buddha. And that is the way that leads to an awakening. But does this really work in the general context? I mean, we can argue no need for insight. We might even argue no need for morality. There's nothing here, no precepts, no nothing about sila, etc. It seems to me that this kind of approach really doesn't work. We simply have to see that this is one stanza, just like this Jan and Abbuji that I have just been discussing, that is one particular poetic expression out of the moment in a particular situation. None of these is meant to give a comprehensive picture of the whole situation. So if we take a momentary picture, a shot taken at a particular situation, as if it were giving us the whole map, I think we are missing the point. And we will be coming to conclusions about the early teachings that, as far as I can see, don't really do them justice. I hope I'm not being too strong here. Yeah, I'm still with Justin. He's given me a lot of food to think and reply. He said, you mentioned that the Bodhisattva is on record for training under other teachers where he would have learned the jhanas. Could you give the references for this? Yeah, and these are from my habilitation. It's on page 175. So the sources where I found such references is the Divya Vadana, the Lalita Vistara, the Mahavastu, the Sangha Bheda Vastu, the Pali commentary to the Terighata. All of these describe some kind of visiting of other teachers before the Bodhisattva met Alara Kalama. Justin also asked for English translations, and for most of these I do not know of English translations. I can only say if you go page 175 of my habilitation, you will find all the references. And I think we can't go much further than that without knowledge of the original languages. Here comes a longer one by Justin. You mentioned that you thought the happiness of the first three jhanas would not have been emphasized by the Bodhisattva's two teachers, and that they were seeing happiness as something problematic and to be wary of happiness. So it would have been a shift of understanding when remembering his childhood and the happiness which is not at all related to sensuality. I would like to challenge that view. Very welcome. You mentioned Majjhima Nikaya 106. Here is a quote from that sutta. He delights in that equanimity, welcomes it, and remains holding to it. As he does so, his consciousness becomes dependent on it and clings to it. A bhikkhu Ananda who is affected by clinging does not attain Nibbana. End of quote. If the Bodhisattva's teacher had been teaching the four jhanas but were wary of happiness and did not emphasize that happiness, is that so different from the advice such as this given by the Buddha? I think the passage is precisely, I would say, pointing to the same point, but the problem that the teachers got stuck at equanimity. The suggestion I was making, maybe I bring in that other passage because, I'm taking it now. Justin had also been quoting that. My suggestion is based on this passage, which Justin has also been quoting from the Majjhima Nikaya 26, the Arya Pariyasana Sutta. The Bodhisattva reflects, I thought, why am I afraid of that pleasure that has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and unwholesome states? I thought I am not afraid of that pleasure since it has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and unwholesome states. So my interpretation, and I hope I was clear that this is just my interpretation, is based precisely on this passage. This passage clearly speaks of him being afraid of pleasure and realizing that there is no need to be afraid of pleasure because it has nothing to do with sensual pleasure and unwholesomeness. And this is the realization that makes him understand what is the path to awakening. The path to awakening is not just jhana itself, but this understanding of the significance of jhana. And so, the way, just my interpretation, you are free to disagree. My understanding is that the Alaraka Lama and Uddaka Ramaputta would have been afraid of pleasure as such. Not making that distinction between sensual pleasure and non-sensual pleasure, between wholesome states and unwholesome states. And precisely, like the flip side of the coin, if you are afraid of pleasure as such, it will be naturally happening that you cling to equanimity. And this is precisely what Majjhima Nikaya 106 is about, because they talk about these immaterial states at that point that Justin had been quoting. That person who does not proceed beyond the immaterial attainments to liberation is precisely because he, and I read it again, he delights in that equanimity, welcomes it, and remains holding to it. And this is precisely out of this current of not seeing what is wholesome, what is unwholesome, but of simply seeing this is pleasant, and as a spiritual practitioner, I should avoid this. Oh, this is neutral. This is what I should be going for. Which is a shift in understanding when one sees pleasure as such is not a problem. The problem is wholesomeness and unwholesomeness. But again, to be clear, this is my interpretation and it's based on this. Why am I afraid of that pleasure? So let me see where I was. Then he had, that was above there, he had brought in a point A, Justin. He's been really giving a lot of stuff for me to talk about, and this is his point B. Furthermore, would not the direct experience of the four jhanas spoken for itself to the Buddha, without him having to go back to a distant memory of childhood? Or here I have put in what was not meant to be my own notes, what I was going to say, it's there already for you. I think the evaluation of the jhanas depends very much on one's attitude. See the present day controversy about its value and relevance. These are the notes that I was supposed to be talking about instead of showing you. the jhanas experienced as such will not be different. I mean, there's no way of attaining the first jhana without having the piti and the sukha, the joy or bliss or rapture and the happiness, but the way how one experiences that, how one evaluates that, is very much a question of one's previous ideas. If one has a framework of seeing this as some sort of divine revelation, one will interpret it as confirming that, or these other views that one finds in the Brahmajala. And if one has this attitude that I assume the Alara Kalam and Udakara Mahamudra may have had, and which one sometimes finds in modern day meditation circles who emphasize the so-called dry insight, then one will really be afraid of that happiness, and one will do one's best not to allow it to happen again or to go through it as quickly as possible. And this also answers the next question of Justin. Actually, I just passed it in for completeness. Would the jhanas not have had the same qualities regardless of his teacher's awareness? Yeah, the basic same qualities are the same, but the evaluation can be vastly different. Then another question by Justin is, he says, these are all useful because they are on the discourse that we are going to be discussing soon. I notice in Majjhima Nikaya 106 no mention of jhana in the sequence and no connection of these bases to jhana. Yeah, again, the problem here is that it is really necessary, I think, to be able to go to the Pali text and see what is really there. And in this case, I think an idea of what's happening could have already been gotten by looking at the footnote that Bhikkhu Bodhi gives in his translation, footnote 1009, where he comments on this expression here. This is the Pali. Vipula mahagata chetasa abhibhuya logam adhintaya manasa. A mind that is abundant and exalted, having transcended the world and made a firm determination with the mind. This phrase precedes what the description of what the going for the immaterial spheres. And as Bhikkhu Bodhi in footnote 1009 points out, the commentary says that this expression refers to absorption. And as far as I am able to say, the expression Mahagata, when it is not used for the Brahma Viharas, in the case of the Brahma Viharas, the expression Mahagata become great refers to the basic nature of these practices. But otherwise, when it's used outside of a Brahma Vihara context, it really seems to refer to absorption. So in Majjhima Nikaya 106, which we are going to see soon, I do, as far as I can see, if I read the Pali, the original, and also we have it in Chinese and in Tibetan also. If we read the original with the knowledge of the original language, we get the impression that jhana is implicit. This is different from the case of Majjhima Nikaya 121. Justin had also mentioned that. That is the smaller discourse on emptiness. There, the terminology is also different. These immaterial attainments or spheres are not referred to as ayatana, a sphere of experience, but as sannyas, usually translated as perception. So in the smaller discourse on emptiness, the commentary also thinks that jhana is implicit and that this practice can only be done based on the, or should be done ideally based on having first of all attained all four material jhanas. And I think it is certainly meaningful to have such profound concentration, but here, because of the terminology used in the discourse being the sannya, the perception, I am not sure that in Majjhima Nikaya 121 this point at issue is the immaterial spheres themselves necessarily. And thus I would not see that absorption there is implied necessarily. However, in the overall discussion, which was also what interests Justin, this idea that the immaterial spheres may be later additions, again we would have difficulties arguing this idea with the discourse like Majjhima Nikaya 121, the smaller discourse on emptiness, which we have in three versions in Pali, in Chinese, in the Madhyama Agama, and as an individual discourse preserved in Tibetan. And they all work through the immaterial spheres with the small difference that the Pali version also has the fourth one, which I think could be a problem of transmission. For them to work through the immaterial spheres as perceptions seems very clear that these notions related to the immaterial spheres were so well known in the early Buddhist circles that they were not only placed within the context of something that one attains as an ayatana, as a sphere of experience after the four absorptions, but also something that can be used as forms of perceptions to cultivate insight. It's a very fascinating discourse and a very profound meditation practice that comes out of that. And I think it would be very difficult to think how this could have come into being if the immaterial spheres were something unknown in early Buddhist circles and only being added by later times. Still with Justin? With regard to the Buddha's studies with his past teachers, in Majjhima Nikaya 26 we have the Buddha here is thinking to himself, certainly Alara Kalama abides knowing and seeing this Dhamma. And then the Buddha tells him, I soon, excuse me, quickly, seems I'm talking too much. I soon quickly entered upon and abided in that Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. Now, this is Justin. I'm unclear why he said he realized that Dhamma with direct knowledge, but then says it does not lead to direct knowledge. Is this not a contradiction? Yeah, again, this type of close analysis really requires going back to the Pali. You see, in the original, the expression we get is Sayan Abhinya. This is this realizing for oneself. And so when we see this Sayan Abhinya, we immediately recognize that the word behind is Abhinya. And Abhinya are of penetrative, higher, direct knowledge, however you like to translate it. There are six different types recognized in the suttas, of which only the last is the destruction of the influx and awakening. But the others are attainment that according to Buddhist tradition are also available to those outside of Buddhist traditions and which in themselves are not liberating, like divine eye, divine ear, etc. So when we see that, then we see that the contradiction that may appear on consulting the English translation can easily be resolved by just looking at the Pali terminology that stands behind. Still, Justin? Again, on Arya Pariyasana Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 26. Here the Buddha seems to speculate that the first jhana may be the path to enlightenment and then realize that it is. He realized that following on that memory of childhood, this topic of jhana is an entirely new topic at this point in the sutta. If he had been practicing jhana under his previous teachers, how can we explain the total absence of any mention of jhana in the section about his teachers? And how can we explain the total absence of any mention of his teachers in the section about jhanas? And one more. If it was known by the community of monks responsible for creating the sutta, that the Buddha practiced the four jhanas under his previous teachers, why would that not mention that in these two suttas, which recount his time with his previous teachers? Yeah, to understand why something is mentioned in a particular context, I think it is important to look at the purpose of a particular discourse. Now, the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 26, as its title says, is on the noble quest. So the purpose of the discourse is to show what is, let me say it a little bit free, what is worthwhile pursuing and what is not worthwhile pursuing. And in a paper I have published last year, on the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta and his Chinese parallels, I have taken up another scholar, Carol Anderson, who also uses the Arya Pariyesana Sutta to come to certain conclusions. So she says, this is her book published 1999 on Pain and Its Ending, page 63. The Arya Pariyesana Sutta shows that certain redactors of the canon conceived of the Buddha's act of teaching without the Four Noble Truths, page 55. The Four Noble Truths emerged in the canonical tradition at a particular point and slowly became recognized as the first teaching of the Buddha, being a doctrine that came to be identified as the central teaching of the Buddha by the time of the commentaries. So, basically she's taking Majjhima Nikaya 26 to argue that the Buddha himself didn't teach the Four Noble Truths. And this, forget about Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta and all the other evidence we might have. Originally, the original teaching was without the Four Noble Truths, and the evidence for that is the Arya Pariyesana Sutta, because look there, the Buddha gets awakened and not a single word about the Noble Truths. So we can conclude that everywhere else where these are found, this is a later edition done at the time of the commentaries. You see what type of argument one can derive when one does not use what I would call the systematic approach and one does not follow the hermeneutical principles laid out so beautifully in that passage by Bhikkhu Bodhi that I read out to you at the beginning. It seems to me totally absurd because the Arya Pariyesana Sutta is not a complete biography or autobiography by the Buddha. It simply focuses on particular aspects. And so one aspect is the contrast between the noble quest and the ignoble quest in the Arya Pariyesana Sutta. And there it is not relevant from the topic to bring in the full exposition of the Four Noble Truths. In the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the topic is what was the first teaching given by the Buddha, and there it is meaningful. And in fact, we get the Four Noble Truths in the same Majjhima Nikaya, in the Satchavibhanga Sutta. So that the same collection of discourses has a discourse which knows that the Four Noble Truths were believed to be the first teaching by the Buddha. It's very difficult to assume that within the same group of reciters we have two completely diverse ideas about what could have been the original teaching of the Buddha. And so the other discourse that Justin mentioned, Majjhima Nikaya 36, again, this is a discussion with somebody who believes in the value of asceticism. So there it is meaningful to bring in everything that is related to that topic. Yeah, I'm not going to go further into this. Any of you who are interested, I'm not sure actually if the paper is already online. I could post it. Maybe I'll post it after the lecture is over. I'll post it on the OLAD. So any of you who likes to read that paper, it's a two-part paper. The first part of the paper on the Dhammacakkappavattana, so you will get this more in detail. But I really think we have to understand that each of the suttas is just giving us a part of the picture. And we cannot assume that every sutta must give us on its own the whole picture, and anything that is missing in that sutta then means that it's missing from the whole picture. So I have finished with Justin. Thanks again for this very for the wealth of inspiring, interesting points and suggestions. I'm with Eric van Horn now. He says, I'm really talking too much today, it seems. Well, I realize that the canonical position, as far as I know, is that the jhanas are practiced sequentially. I do know of instances where people attain jhanas out of sequence. Is it possible that jhana practice does not have to be quite as regimented as the texts seem to suggest? Yeah, this is a more practice-related question, so my reply is basically based on my practical understanding, and I'm not able to pull out suttas to support it, but the way I understand it is that these four jhanas are speaking about progressively deepening levels of concentration. Thus, as far as I can understand, it is virtually impossible to go, say, to the fourth jhana without passing to 1, 2, and 3. But this does not mean at all that somebody might not subjectively have the experience of going directly into the fourth jhana. But I would simply say he or she passes through 1, 2, 3 so fast that they don't even notice. But if I stay with my water simile, I had this water simile about the head maybe popping out of the water. So if I am climbing up a tower to jump into the water, and I say, let's say there's the levels of water, 1 meter below surface, 2 meter below surface, 3 meter below surface, 4 meter below surface, depending on how high I have climbed before, to that much I will go deeper into the water. But it is impossible for me to go down to level 4 meters below water without passing through 1, 2, 3. But if I really have gone up so high that I can go all the way down to 4 meters below water surface, I'll pass through 1, 2, 3 very, very quickly. Yeah, I think that simile works. And we could maybe say the tower is the degree of letting go and seclusion from sensuality, etc., that has been built up before. So in practical terms, it's perfectly possible to go straight away into one particular jhana. But I think it would involve a quick deepening of concentration that passes through the other levels. There's a question by Martali Turner. But also changing objects of attention. Marta, I'm not sure. I assume this is in relation to what I've just been discussing from Eric von Horn. I don't know. Maybe you're asking if one can change objects of attention while being inside of an absorption. Is that the question? Or maybe I continue with the next point. And in the meantime, Marta, if you could write a little more, then it's easier for me to understand. It's very nice to get your comments right away during the lecture. Then it's perhaps a little more lively, but sometimes this monk here, his mind is so bad he doesn't understand what you're saying. Forgive him. This is while Marta has time to write later on the forum. Okay, but it's also nice to discuss it here. This is a comment by Dharmadasa and Frank K. They both drew attention to the presence of the terms sampajanya and sati in the third jhana. And then Frank K. Made the argument, the overlap in sati and sampajanya to me strongly indicates that while absorbed in third jhana, one can be doing any of the four satipatthanas. Yeah, I think that is perhaps a interpretation that is a little bit too narrow according to my understanding, because sati and sampajana, even though they are mentioned in the four satipatthanas, they are there mentioned as qualities that one uses to cultivate satipatthana. They are not in themselves necessarily satipatthana. There's also the quality of being diligent or ardent, and there's the quality of being free from desires for the world. These are all qualities that come together in order to cultivate satipatthana, but the very fact that they are mentioned themselves does not mean automatically this must also be satipatthana. And here I have an example for you from the Majjhima Nikaya. We have the expression sampajana musa bhasita. Somebody speaks a lie, a falsehood with sampajana. This is certainly not a question of satipatthana. This is simply using the same word, sampajana, sampajana, sampajanya, in order to express the idea that somebody speaks a lie clearly knowing that it is a lie. So I can speak a falsehood not being quite sure, and I can really know, look, what I'm saying now is exactly the opposite of what really happened. And for this kind of conscious lying, we have the expression sampajana mosa bhasita. So I think this is a good example to show that the fact that sampajanya or sampajana appears somewhere does not in itself mean this is a form of satipatthana practice. And then Frank K. also mentions that the four satipatthanas are called the samadhi nimitta in Majjhima Nikaya 44. And this he suggests is another argument for saying that satipatthana can be done while one is inside of a jhana. Here I think the term nimitta has a causal sense. And the question that satipatthana can lead to concentration is something we will be taking up in Majjhima Nikaya 76 after the discourse on imperturbability. And so here I think we need to distinguish between that which can cause a samadhi and that which is samadhi itself. However, even that which is samadhi itself, as we saw, I believe last lecture or the lecture before, based on an input made by Manfred Wiesberger, that the word samadhi is used for insight meditation. And I think this is really crucial in this whole discussion, that samadhi and jhana are not synonymous. They are related terms, they have considerable overlap, but they cannot be simply taken one in place of the other. There is samadhi which is not jhana. And so whenever we get a reference to samadhi, this does not automatically refer to jhana attainment. And I think this is an important point to keep in mind. Then there is another question by Frank K. Some suttas give the impression that they are about the immaterial spheres. Sorry, I forgot to mention the context. Some suttas give the impression that they are absolutely necessary, indispensable, such as Parinibbana Sutta, where the Buddha, before he passes away, goes to attainments 1 to 8, then 8 to 1. Also, there are a few suttas, and you can't remember which, that say something to the effect that destruction of the asavas depends on the first, second, third, and fourth formless attainment. Yet in Digha Nikaya 2, Samanya Pala Sutta, which seems to be a very comprehensive description of the set of techniques organized in stages of awakening, there's a very conspicuous absence of the four formless attainments. Why? Yeah, I'm not sure if the Mahaparinibbana Sutta is wanting to present the immaterial attainments as indispensable for the path to awakening. I think what it depicts is the Buddha at the moment of his passing away being so calm and centered that he is able to just play one move through all these different samadhi levels as if somebody would be playing a piano. You just go bop, 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 and bop, 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 bop. So there's no... The point of this description is not to say these are indispensable requisites for awakening. The point is more to depict the Buddha's mastery. His meditative mastery, even in a situation that other people experience with a lot of anxiety, fear, insecurity, and distraction. He is there, is about to pass away, and he still just goes zhup, zhup, through all these sets and then passes away from the fourth jhana. Could even be used as another argument for saying that the fourth jhana corresponds to the immaterial spheres, because they are just saying at what level of the mind he's passing away, and he's no longer taking this object refinement through the immaterial attainments, but much rather just directing the mind to Nibbana. And the other passages that Frank mentions, they are also, and I think Venerable Xianchen has already pointed it out in the blog, the other passages are also not saying that one has to do insight with all of these eight, but they are usually just saying you take one of these and you develop insight with them. So they are not, they are like alternative options. And in the Samanyapala Sutta, again, the discourse is meant to show the fruits of the being a samana, a recluse, to a king. So it shows him the different levels of happiness through the jhanas, but then because the formless attainments are can be understood, as far as I can see, I said that before, as pertaining to the same level of concentration as the fourth jhana, they are kind of implicitly covered in that. And since the topic is to a king, to show what how meaningful or fruitful living a life as a Buddhist monk can be, it then instead moves on to various supernatural powers, which I assume for a relatively gross person like this king, he had killed his father according to what we are told, and so he seems to be a rather gross kind of person. It would probably be much more meaningful to talk to such a person about things like, oh, they can fly and they can do all these kind of things, instead of going to this very refined immaterial spheres. So I think, I'm not saying this is the must be like this, but I think if we always look at the context of the sutta, we often find that there is a way of seeing why it is meaningful here to have the sad and meaningful there not to have it. So this concludes my discussion of jhana. And now we come to Majjhima Nikaya 74. This is from Marta Lee Turner. And first of all, she says that in the Madhyama Agama version, five stanzas are at the end, and in the Anuguttara, the first three of these. And she's curious about the other two. So I'm just pasting them in here. I do not delight in death, and I do not wish for rebirth. In accordance with the proper time, established in my mindfulness and guided attentiveness, in a bamboo grove at Pisali, my life will come to an end. Beneath the bamboos of that grove. Hasn't catched the last one. Beneath the bamboos of that grove, I shall attain remainderless final nirvana. These are the two verses found at the end of the Madhyama Agama version, which have no parallel in the Pali version, but we have similar versions in the Theragata, the collection of elder monks, under attributed also to Anuruddha. So I am sometimes here for the purpose of presenting here in class. I can't present the full entire discourse, because with all these repetitions and things, I think there would be no time for discussion. I would just be reading discourse, discourse, discourse. So I sometimes select, and it's good if you let me know that you feel that something important may have been missed, so that I can supplement it next time. And I had decided to leave out these last two stanzas, because I assume that they are a later edition in the Madhyama Agama version. Very natural, again, in oral transmission, this idea that in the bamboo grove at Vesali, he already says, I will die in such and such a place, is associated with Anuruddha also in the Pali tradition. But there they come as part of his Theragatas. So they are here a set of stanzas associated with Anuruddha, and here a set of stanzas associated with Anuruddha. So it's a very natural thing that in one tradition they come together. But I wanted to focus particularly on the point of this, which actually nobody has really been so much discussing, which I found very fascinating, this idea that this whole celestial travel may go back to this idea of a manomayakaya, a mind-made body. And that was why I didn't really take up those two verses. So, and this is Marta's conclusion. These are not individually significant differences so far as I can see. These, excuse me, collectively do not add to some big differences so far as I can see. And then she says, I conjecture that this may point either to a long history of separate transmission or possibly to transmission during conditions that favored small changes. And she asks, how? Yeah, this is again my one of my favorite topics in this kind of courses, so I can't miss such a nice question. Yeah, so first of all, yeah, we have overall rather long history of separate transmission. I mean, overall, this we are talking about 4 centuries of all transmission, and we have to understand that the separation of the transmission lineages did not somehow come into being only when there were fully formed Buddhist schools. This is a very important point, I think, to keep in mind, but that very soon, with the spread of the Buddhist communities over different areas of India, there would have been some degree of geographical separation, and that the geographical separation may have been, in fact, a strong contributing factor to the formation of Buddhist schools. So it is quite possible that these versions which we are now having here in front of us as parallel versions in the context of all transmission separated at a very, very early time. And that for several centuries they were passed on fairly independently. We simply do not know, but this is an important point to keep in mind. And the other thing is that the Buddhist tradition of reciters differed fundamentally from the transmission of the Veda. You see, the Buddhist oral transmission would have been modeled on the Vedic precedent, and the transmission of the Veda was done with an impressive degree of accuracy. But these reciters involved in transmitting the Vedas were trained in the art of memorizing from their early youth onward. I think between 8 and 13 you start the training. And if you are much older than that, they won't even take you, because you have basically gone beyond the time where you can really be trained in this art of memorizing. And they were memorizing things that they did not understand. This has been reported even from modern-day India, of those who still memorize these texts, that they are being trained to memorize something that they do not understand. Only after having memorized the whole thing will they be taught the meaning of it. So they understand the single words because it's their language, maybe, at that time at least, not in modern days, but they can't make sense out of it. And the Buddhist transmission was decisively different. First of all, they were memorizing things that they did, or at least were supposed and expected to understand. And then the monks were not all Brahmins, and not even all Brahmins were trained in recitation in their youth. Buddhist monastics were drawn from all different social strata and castes in ancient India. So we have quite a number of monks who would have had no training whatsoever in memorizing. And this is precisely why we find so many repetitions in the Buddhist discourses. These were tools meant to facilitate memorization. And in this kind of setting, what we would expect is precisely what we find. Small changes. Because those who recite the discourses understood the meaning, it would easily happen that they express what they believe to be the same meaning, or what maybe even is the same meaning, with slightly different words. This is precisely why the Vedic reciters were learning to memorize before they understood. Because this has also been proved in modern studies on memory, that if you do not understand what you are meant to memorize, the similarity between the original and what you reproduce is closer than if you understand it. If you understand it, it's maybe a little bit easier for you to remember what it's all about, But there is this tendency of our memory to introduce these very slight little changes in wording. Then Otmar Domainko, he and also Robert Krosh pointed out to the similarity between these eight qualities, we have them here, and the Noble Eightfold Path, which I find was a very helpful point. So Otmar Domainko says, because these words are spoken to an advanced disciple and bhikkhu, therefore right speech and right action are not mentioned. Then one, few or no desire, and two, contentment, and three, seclusion covers right livelihood. This is the division of sila. What follows is the division of samadhi, four, effort, five, mindfulness, six, concentration. And then the division of panya, wisdom, can be seen as seven, having insight into permanence, wisdom, and eight, no proliferation. I have abbreviated his presentation a little bit, but I found that was a very nice way of interrelating them. Then this is Robert Krosh. I find that the eight thoughts nicely build on each other, so that the previous thoughts always support the thought to come. Overall, the eight thoughts are an excellent short training manual. Since the practice of the thoughts can lead to arahantship, they should in some way correlate to the Eightfold Noble Path. In fact, right view and right intention, the practice are, to me, the main theme of the discourse. And then he just gives a few helpful reflections on some of the points. He says, number one, not having desire is really about not boasting about one's achievements. And then number two, contentment, taking garment just to dress the body, just eating to maintain the body without indulging in these things. In fact, these are two specific examples of having no desires. Number three, seclusion. For me, one of the main messages here is to refrain from enforcing the ego through the interaction with others. I thought that was very beautiful. And number eight, abstaining from proliferation. This factor supports the practice, because especially in seclusion it can easily happen that one loses oneself in all the entertaining thoughts which the mind likes to ponder on for distraction. I think all of those who have been on retreat can directly relate to this problem. And then he asks, how can we distinguish, how can we draw a clear line between reflection about the Dharma and proliferation? And here I have a reply. I'm borrowing a reply from Kim Allen. She made a very beautiful contribution on this. She says, I find a link to the Dvaitavitaka Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 19, in which the Buddha describes how, before his awakening, he learned to divide his thoughts into wholesome and unwholesome. Excuse me. The Bodhisattva also realizes that even if he thinks and ponders on wholesome thoughts, night and day, and now she's quoting, with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body, and when the body is tired, the mind becomes strained. And when the mind is strained, it is far from concentration. And this is her summary. Thinking makes one tired. This is clear on retreat practice, when there's far more energy available after discursive thought subsides. That's so true. Hence the eighth instruction to let go of papancha. Even thoughts about the Dhamma must be abandoned at some point as distractions. And then this is another very helpful observation from her. Regarding the intellectual person's tendency to elevate thinking as an inherently worthy activity, I found that perceiving the mind as the sixth sense base was very helpful in undercutting this tendency. Something has gone lost there. Indulging pleasant tastes or touches might be obvious as persons of sensual desires, but truly seeking pleasant ideas and reflections is quite similar, just related to the mind base instead. Yeah, that was actually, thank you, Kim. I hadn't really thought about it in that direction. I thought, and I find that very helpful to see all this, especially for me as an academic, to see all my clever thoughts. It's just another sense base, and same problem with all the rest. Very good. Yeah, these were my comments to what was on the forum. I'm not sure, Marta, if you have something to comment now. Ah, there we are. Thank you. I'm assuming that the transmission history of the individual suttas is not necessarily the same for all in Madhyama Agama and its parallels. My list of small differences in our sutta gave me the impression that it had an unusually large number of small differences. I was wondering what could be learned about not the big picture of sutta transition, but of the history of individual texts. Yeah, the second next discourse we are not being able to cover today, Madhyama Agama 76, has major differences. So much so that it is not possible for us to pinpoint which of two discourses is the right parallel. In fact, it was only in preparing this course that I discovered a second parallel for it. So as we continue, we find that sometimes things are very close, sometimes there's a lot of small differences, sometimes there are large differences. And inasmuch as these texts come as part of one collection, of course we don't know exactly when this collection was finalized. But for the purpose of oral transmission, I believe that these four agamas or four nikayas as basic structures enabling transmission of a sizable group of texts within the abilities to memorize of a trained Buddhist reciters would have come into being at a relatively early stage, but would in themselves not have been fixed and been evolving as collections that within themselves readjust the sequence where groups of discourses from one collection were brought into the other. We have evidence that suggests that. So it's difficult for us to say when, say, the Madhyama Agama as we have it now in Chinese translation, reached its individual point of closure within the context of oral transmission. We only have the final point of when it was translated, but that puts things much too late because we see that there's no influence on these texts from the centuries, several centuries that precede the actual translation. So the degree to which we can think of this as history of an individual text within the collection or as a history of the whole collection is somewhat difficult to assess. And this is something that has been with us throughout these past 2 years and this year, that with some Madhyama Agama discourses we feel so close to the Pali parallel, and with others we are just so far away. It's really amazing, and we will pick up that topic. I'm glad you always bring up these topics that I really like so much about the transmission, and that I'm very glad that about that. We will come back to that when we look at Madhyama Agama 76. This is where it would also really strike me when I looked at that discourse. So, yeah, we have enough time to get into the discourse on imperturbability. And in the course of the discussion so far, we have already covered some material that is actually directly relevant to this discourse. So, I start reading from the discourse. Let me just check. Yeah. At that time, the Blessed One addressed the monks. Sensual pleasures are impermanent, unreal, false, of a false nature, being indeed illusory, deceptive and delusive. Sensual pleasures now or in the future, material forms now or in the future, all of these are the domain of Mara. They are indeed Mara's bait, since because of them countless evil and unwholesome states arise in the mind, states such as covetousness, hatred and contention, which create an obstruction for a noble disciple in training. A learned noble disciple contemplates thus. The Blessed One has taught that sensual pleasures are impermanent, etc., and delusive. If I attain an expansive state of mind and dwell in it, overcoming worldliness by taking control of my mind, then in this way countless evil and unwholesome states will not arise in the mind. States such as covetousness, hatred and contention, which create obstructions for a noble disciple in training. By means of this practice, by means of this training, by cultivating thus broadly and extensively, he attains purity of the mind in regard to that sphere. Having attained purity of the mind in regard to that sphere, such a monk will either gain entry into imperturbability right here, or else employ wisdom for the sake of liberation. At a later time, when the body breaks up and life ends, because of that former mental disposition, he will certainly attain the imperturbable. This is reckoned the first explanation of the path to pure imperturbability. The attaining purity of the mind in regard to that sphere would be the way the Chinese version expresses the need to have some degree of concentration. But what I find particularly interesting, what I would like to comment on a little bit more, is that this attaining of imperturbability at the time the body breaks up and life ends. We have a slightly different expression in the Pali version. It speaks of the evolving consciousness that may pass on to the imperturbable, the samvartanika vijnanam. And because there was no counterpart to this precise expression in the Chinese, in fact, Bhikkhu Bodhi, we had discussed this, and he had asked me to check if it's in the Tibetan. That was a long time ago when I started to do this study. And in the Tibetan, we have precisely the same, as you can see here below. This is the Tibetan counterpart. The Nampa Shepa is the vijnana, and the Kupa is the moving on, the Samvartanika vijnana. And this, I thought to take this as a short opportunity of talking about consciousness in the context of rebirth. So in Digha Nikaya 28, we get a discussion of different ways of gabbhavakanti, of entry into the womb, of conception. And there is a distinction there. This could either happen while one is aware of this, sampajanya again, not a form of satipatthana practice, but one is aware, one clearly knows that now conception is taking place, or it could happen when conception takes place and one is not aware, which is the average case. And then the question is, of course, what is it that gets into the womb? And here we get information from the Mahanidana Sutta. The expression is vijnanam vahi ananda matu kutchina okkamissata. If consciousness ananda would not descend into the mother's womb. So it is consciousness which descends into the mother's womb. Consciousness is that which is responsible for the continuity between one life and another. But now there's a misunderstanding about this consciousness reported in Majjhima Nikaya 38. There's somebody who thinks, idam tang vijnanam sandhavati sangsarati ananyam. It is this same consciousness that runs and wanders through the round of rebirth, not another. So this person has the misunderstanding that this continuation is a unchanging entity. This is not the Buddhist view. Instead, and here we get the expression in Digha Nikaya 28 again, it's the Vijnana Sota, the stream of consciousness, which moves on from one life to another, from one world to another. So we have basically three aspects of meaning of Vijnana in early Buddhism. One is the fifth aggregate. Here Vijnana is distinct from the other immaterial aggregates of feeling, perception, informations or volitions. But at other times, this is the second sense of Vijnana, it also can stand for the mind in its totality. One example, and I'll just give you the reference, is the expression Savijnanakekaya, the body with consciousness. Here this means body is the material part, and Vijnana here functions as a header for all mental aspects. It doesn't mean the body with consciousness but without feeling, perception and formations. It rather means the body with mind. And the third meaning of Vijnana is to stand for that which is reborn, for the continuity from one life to another, as we saw in these passages. And this is the sense that we have behind this Sangvatantanika Vijnana. So it's intriguing that we do not have this expression in the Madhyama Agama, and I'm not sure the Tibetan is Mula Savastivada, the Chinese is Savastivada. In terms of school, I don't think we can see this as some school influences, because the Mula Savastivada has it. I assume some problem in transmission. Which one is the earlier version, I'm not able to say. But it is clear, I think, that the idea of a Sangvatantanika Vijnana, a continuity of the stream of consciousness, is something that we find in other suttas. So this is nothing new, and this difference is, after all, not a substantial difference. Continue with the discourse. Again, a learned, noble disciple contemplates thus. If there are forms, they are all made up of the four elements and what is derived from the four elements. The four elements are of an impermanent nature, unsatisfactory and subject to cessation. This is the second explanation of the path to pure imperturbability. I'm abbreviating a little bit. Again, a learned noble disciple contemplates thus. Sensual pleasures now or in the future, forms now or in the future, sensual perceptions, now or in the future, perceptions of form, now or in the future. All of these perceptions are of an impermanent nature, unsatisfactory and subject to cessation. This is reckoned the third explanation of the path to pure imperturbability. So if we look at this in comparative perspective, we find some differences. The first approach, maybe I leave the summary out for a moment before we come to that. In the Pali, we have sensual pleasures and sensual perceptions. In the Chinese, sensual pleasures and material forms. In the second, in Pali, we have sensual pleasures, sensual perceptions, material forms, all three. In the Madhyama Agama, only material forms. And then in the third, we have the whole group. Sensual pleasures, sensual perceptions, material forms, and perceptions of forms. In both. It seems to me that it is possible that in both versions, and the Tibetan there is fairly close also to the Chinese, if I remember correctly, that we have in all versions some problem of transmission, which is very easy. I mean, even I assume for you to follow while I'm reading, one gets a little bit like, oh, what's it all about? And it gets a little tiring. So you can imagine that somebody reciting it, something from earlier or later might slip in. My personal hypothesis is that the point is that there are three ways of progressing to the level of imperturbability. And then these are based either on understanding of sensual pleasures. So the dynamic is to go for to understand that sensual pleasures are a problem. It's a search of happiness in the wrong place. And the other one is to have this understanding of what matter is really. What really matters is not matter. that material forms anything, my body, your body, his, his body, is just made out of these four basic qualities, hardness, wetness, warmth, and motion. And there's nothing really so different between them. There's nothing so special about them. And the third one is to see that perceptions of these other two end perceptions are impermanent. So these are three insight approaches that help one to deepen concentration to the level of imperturbability. This is how I would put them basically together from a practical perspective. None of the versions we have gives it exactly the way I'm presenting it here now. Each of them has it a little bit more. And as I say, this is just my reconstruction. But in this way, I understand how this type of insight informs one's practice of samatha, so that one reaches a degree of the mind that becomes imperturbable, unshaken. Now, after these three modes of imperturbability, we get another set of instructions, and this is on the theme of nothingness. This is the third of the immaterial spheres we have been discussing before, and is also a form of imperturbability, but not as broadly as the fourth jhana. It's more profound. And here again we are shown how certain insights can help to progress towards this experience of nothingness. I read from the sutta. Again, a learned noble disciple contemplates thus: sensual perceptions now in the future, perceptions of form now in the future, and the perception of imperturbability. All of these perceptions are of an impermanent nature, unsatisfactory, and subject to cessation. At that time he will attain the perception of nothingness. This is reckoned the first explanation of the path to the sphere of pure nothingness. Again, a learned noble disciple contemplates thus: this world is empty, empty of a self and anything belonging to a self, empty of anything permanent, empty of anything enduring, empty of continuous existence, empty of anything unchanging. And this is the second explanation of the path to the sphere of pure nothingness. Again, a learned noble disciple contemplates thus: I do not act for another, nor do I act for myself. This is reckoned the third explanation of the path to the sphere of pure nothingness. Yeah, and Pali is slightly different. The first approach, it just speaks of the cessation of all perceptions being peaceful. The second is quite similar, only that it's simply, in the Pali version, the emphasis is on the world is empty of self and anything that belongs to a self. It does not have this continuity there of empty of permanent, enduring, etc. The third is quite different, and the translation of this passage in the Chinese has been a real challenge. And if I'm honest, we are really not quite sure what it is about. The Pali version has a series of, like, I'm not anything anywhere at all. And this is probably, it seems at least more meaningful to me. So, the insights that can inform progress towards the attainment of nothingness is one, to see the cessation of perceptions, or also that perceptions are unsatisfactory and subject to cessation, impermanent. Basically, to understand, to have a disenchantment with perceptions. The second is that the anatta, it's straightforward emptiness teaching. And the third one I have here is the Pali in full: I'm not anything belonging to anyone anywhere. Is there anything belonging to me in anyone anywhere? It's very, very very beautiful passage. So all these are insights that inform progress to nothingness. And now we get neither perception nor non-perception. Again, a learned, noble disciple contemplates thus. Sensual pleasures now in the future, forms now in the future, sensual perceptions now in the future. Perceptions of form now in the future, the perception of imperturbability and the perception of the sphere of nothingness. All of these perceptions are of an impermanent nature, unsatisfactory and subject to cessation. At that time he will attain neither perception nor non-perception. This is reckoned the explanation of the path of pure neither perception nor non-perception. At that time, the Venerable Ananda was fanning the Buddha. Then the Venerable Ananda, holding his hands with palms together towards the Buddha, said, "Blessed One, suppose a monk practices thus. There is no I, nor anything belonging to me. I will not be, what belongs to me will not be. If something has earlier come to exist, it will be extinguished. And he attains equanimity by practicing thus. Blessed monk, a monk who practices thus, will he ultimately attain final nirvana?" The Blessed One replied, "Ananda, this matter is uncertain. There are some who attain it and some who do not attain it. Ananda, if the monk delights in that equanimity, becomes attached to that equanimity, becomes established in that equanimity, Ananda, then practicing thus, the monk will certainly not attain final nirvana. Ananda, in his practice, there is still a remainder of clinging, namely to the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception. Among states of existence, this is supreme. And this is what that monk is clinging to." Venerable Ananda said, "Blessed monk, so that monk is practicing with the remainder of clinging." The Blessed One said, "Ananda, in this way a monk is indeed practicing with the remainder of clinging. And if he does not practice with such clinging, he attains nirvana. We had briefly discussed that before. The problem that even the profound equanimity of deep concentration experiences can become an object of clinging and prevent one from breaking through to the final goal." Then the Venerable Ananda, holding his hands with palms together toward the Buddha, said, "The Blessed One has explained the path to pure imperturbability. He has explained the path to the sphere of pure nothingness. He has explained the path to pure neither perception nor non-perception. He has explained nirvana without remainder. Blessed One, what is noble liberation?" The Blessed One replied, "Ananda, a learned noble disciple contemplates thus. Sensual pleasures, etc. The perception of neither perception nor non-perception. All of these perceptions are of an impermanent nature, unsatisfactory and subject to cessation. This is what is called one's own existence. Sakkaya, also identity, sense of identity, what I am." I continue with the discourse. "If there is one's own existence, then there is birth, old age, disease and death. Ananda, if there is this reality, total extinction, remainderless cessation, no further existence, then there will be no birth, old age, disease and death. The noble disciple contemplates thus. If anything exists, it certainly has the nature of liberation. If there is nirvana without remainder, this is called the deathless. With such contemplation, such view, he will certainly attain liberation of the mind from the influx of sensual desire, from the influx of existence, and from the influx of ignorance. Being liberated, he knows he is liberated, knowing as he truly is that birth is ended. The holy life has been established. What was to be done has been done. There will not be another existence. Ananda, I have now explained to you the path to pure imperturbability. I have explained the path to the sphere of pure nothingness. I have explained the path to pure neither perception nor non-perception. I have explained nirvana without remainder. And I have explained noble liberation. What a teacher does for his disciples out of great compassion, with kind thoughts of empathy, seeking their benefit and welfare, seeking their peace and happiness, I have now done. You must moreover act yourselves. Go to a secluded place, to the base of a tree in a forest, to an empty quiet place, to meditate and reflect. Do not be negligent. Be diligent and increase your efforts, lest you later have regrets. This is my teaching. This is my instruction. The main point that I see in this discourse is again the topic of interrelationship between tranquility and insight. And what to me comes over particularly strongly is the substantial contribution that insight can make to the development of tranquility. And this is not just insight about how to deepen concentration, but this is proper Buddhist teachings on impermanence, on not-self, etc. I find this really fascinating. And so I want to conclude with a verse from the Dhammapada as the main point. There's no absorption for one bereft of wisdom, and there's no wisdom for one who does not meditate. Absorption, meditate in Pali are the same words. It's nati jhana apanyasya, panya nati ajhayato. One is just a noun, the other is a verb. And then it continues, one who has both absorption and wisdom, such a one is close to nirvana indeed. So that's it for today. Thank you very much for your attention. I've gone 5 minutes over time. I think next time maybe we'll be a little bit shorter. Thanks for all the very interesting contributions on the forum, and I hope you will continue discussing with me on this lecture also.